I have a couple of thoughts, actually I have a bunch of thoughts, but I'll limit it to about two or three. Brian?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you had mentioned the point with regards to this 81 city tour that the FCC has actually been convening. There's something of an irony about this entire tour. Back in 2002 and 2003 with the FCC and their controversial media ownership rule provisions, they tried to basically ram that through, comparatively speaking, in the dead of night. Commissioners Michael Compson and Jonathan Adelstein had called for, let's have a tour, maybe like 12 cities across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Officially, the FCC held just one tour in the one city hearing, one in Richmond, Virginia, that was held in the run-up to that media ownership rule rewrite. And Michael Powell, son of Colin Powell, who was the chair of the FCC at the time, actually dismissed the idea with contempt. He actually was quoted as saying, "There's no reason for the FCC to receive information from the public in this digital era of media and have to use a 19th century whistle-stop tour." Those were his words. And so yet, what are the FCC doing now with the digital conversion? A 19th century whistle-stop tour, and one that's not done very well. You're finding, however, instances like, for example, in San Francisco, where actually a lot of community organizers were able to hold press conferences and get an amazing amount of public response regarding this stuff. I'm also waiting for hearings on Atlanta, and they're coming to Chicago, where I live, November 20th. It's going to be like the second to last hearing there, and that's going to prove to be very interesting at the very least. So there's that great irony there that the FCC is doing what was decried just a few years ago and as its apparently main operational strategy with not much success. The phenomenon that Bill had talked about, or I think actually it was Bill there, had talked about regarding moving channels to the digital tier like public, like PBS, like C-SPAN, like public educational and government channels. That phenomenon actually has a name. It's called channel slamming. And that's basically where commercial broadcasters, be it mostly cable and also phone companies with their analog of cable, like AT&T and their new U-verse, are basically shoving any kind of non-commercial content to a what's being termed a digital ghetto. Basically on a single channel, usually in the digital tier, and usually without even the knowledge of broadcasters who are involved with these channels, when they discover it, they don't find out about it until it's already happened. And that's been something that people have been fighting around about around the country in this. So you're not alone on this.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, on this fight. I would disagree to some extent with regards to the point you raised regarding the concern that I think even after February 17th that things will be fine, especially where I think, and there's been evidence about this that's been bearing out, that increasingly what's now analog media and digital technologies are going to, over the next decade or so, basically smear into one and the same. There'll probably be some exceptions. I don't think radio is probably going to become digitized because experiments about that I don't think are bearing as much fruit as people had anticipated. But over time, and probably within a decade or so, what we perceive as media, broadcast, television among them, and what we perceive as the internet are probably going to be the same thing, effectively. And so I don't think that, and that's basically going to be connected with regards to the digital divide and digital access, where you're finding in the United States that that is leveling off. People who probably don't have internet access by now, for the most part, I don't think are going to get it. And so that means that I think that they're not going to be able to get the transmissions of that. And this is something we could disagree with, but this is my reading of the situation. That I think that you could see perhaps maybe as much as a third of Americans not get media because they're not going to be on that side of the digital divide.
Disagree strongly.
What do you think?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is similar to models in the history of any diffusion of any technology, that, you know, there's a certain bell curve associated with it, and when we reach into the later adopter stages, sometimes technology gets adopted by fiat, if not by purpose. People will eventually replace televisions. Whether they replace them with a television or replace them with a different device remains to be seen, but the market is driving toward merged devices. And so, you know, every TV you buy is going to have the ability to draw in a signal from someplace at some point, whether it's a line signal or a wireless signal. And, you know, with the merger of your platform into multimedia platforms, at some point it doesn't become unreasonable to expect that as people turn on their device, they'll receive a signal and they may not even know where the signal is coming from. That may not be a year from now, but it may be 5 years or 7 years from now. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, I think increasingly it becomes both a commercial necessity and a public good, a public necessity to provide ubiquitous wireless communication or ubiquitous communication.
Yeah, that I agree with.
And I think that as that occurs and communication essentially becomes free, and it becomes in the economic interest of manufacturers and content providers to assure that people have the opportunity to take advantage of that free backbone, that the final vestiges, you know, there's probably some asymptotic ad nature of right. the adoption curve, but I think it's not 33%. I think it's, you know, 3% or less as you move out toward the end who may or may not be dragged kicking and screaming into that.
I think that the point you're raising here actually dovetails with the fight that I've been involved with regards to network neutrality and what basically amounts to internet freedom and access. Increasingly, internet access in the United States, unlike a lot of other developed countries and increasingly a lot of countries around the world worldwide, here it's seen as a commodity. Less so as something like a public resource like water or electricity, where here everyone has it no matter where your standing in the society is, no matter what your income is. And worldwide, that's increasingly the case where the internet is being seen in that. Here, it's not, and it needs to be. And that's, I think, a policy fight that will probably prove well here, and which, frankly, I hope you're right. I don't think so, but that's, I think, where if we fight along those lines, that, you know, what I'm saying is chicken little alarmism will hopefully be just that. And, you know, this is one instance where I don't like to be wrong, but in this case, I hope I am. Other thoughts?
Again, I think the element of externalities in this is really an interesting aspect that probably needs to be understood as this, as somebody writes the history, the short-term history of this a year or two from now. You know, to the extent that to a large extent this was undertaken as a means of realizing revenue from the sale of the analog spectrum and less a conscious strategic decision to advance digital technology. In fact, what's occurred is the fact that the U.S. government has done this has probably accelerated the adoption of digital technology by, you know, some non-trivial time period. I'm not sure when the digital signal would have reached 85 or 95% as it probably will in the next year had it not been for this mandate, but I suspect it would not have been by February 17th or, you know, May or August, wherever it might be. And I think with the acceleration of the availability of digital signal and the potential value that represents in interactivity and in, you know, public access and in the merger of platforms and how a lot of that stuff will drive forward and drive the commercial marketplace, the manufacturers and the software providers and the content providers, I think that, you know, this will ultimately have an effect of making this new digital age, for, you know, the risk of being trite, a reality much sooner than it ever would have been in the past.
There's a concern there that I read, especially of the way the United States is doing the conversion as opposed to that you're finding in other countries. Take Britain, for example. The conversion is underway now, and I say underway because the conversion in the UK is going to take place over the course of 4 years. It started in 2008, will conclude in 2012. What's going on there is basically going region by region, practically neighborhood by neighborhood, to make sure that, okay, some community, they're all digital. Okay, let's start, shut off their analog signal. They're all digital now. Do the same thing for a neighborhood and neighborhood, with the plan being that over the course of 4 years' time, all of the UK will be under a digital broadcasting. Analog will be shut off. Here, we're going cold turkey. February 17, 2009, make or break. And especially where in Britain you're still finding problems, despite the fact that per capita they're spending a lot more money. Their awareness and the matters regarding this of greater public awareness are at levels far higher than that in the United States, I think. And yet you're seeing that they're doing it in much more smart fashion with still problems cropping up. But nonetheless, we're doing it in what I'm reading to be a much more haphazard manner. We're going cold turkey all at once, and the hope would be we're going to clean up the mess, if there is any, afterwards. And I'm thinking this is just going to be, and I think this is actually one reason why I think it's going to be, at least at the outset, so dire. Michael.
I was curious, Bill, could you say a little bit more about the project that you're working on with your undergrads, getting them involved in this? It sounds really interesting, and it's, you know, I also teach history broadcasting, and, mm-hmm. and covering this material starts, you know, like your eyes start to glaze over, and it sounds mm-hmm. like esoterica, and I think it's just has lots and lots of potential, so I'm interested in hearing more about how you developed it and what your plans are.
Yeah, well, the well, in the course announcement, it makes clear that there is going to be this service learning component. So they haven't signed up for the course yet, but you know, they'll know at least, or they will have had advance warning that they're getting into this.
It's a prerequisite, this is a mandatory stepping stone class students have to take.
No, it's an elective. Okay. So yeah, we'll see if this
I'm just curious what your enrollment
is. I get, you know, 18 instead of 24 per section, that makes me happy too. So but the doomsday scenario, I found that you know, these sort of discourses of tsunami, train wreck, and so forth are actually very effective in grabbing their attention and motivating them. And so I'm not afraid of, even though I'm suspicious of the tsunami, train wreck, you know, government screwed it all up sorts of tropes, but I think that is an effective way to give them a stake in what's happening, especially since there is widespread ignorance, and when they learn, like, you know, oh my God, my television is going to go off in, you know, however much time. So the way that I went about it, as I mentioned, Granville, very small town, but talked to the city or the village government. And I am now officially the DTB point person for Granville, Ohio, and surrounding areas. An unsalaried position.
You got to work on that, man.
And I think if I had more time, and here's part of my interest in localism, is what counts as local. I am mm-hmm. defining the local in specific ways that don't necessarily relate to how this DTV conversion is going to go down. As you were pointing out, you know, depending on where you are in relation to the transmitter, your idea of how your local community is constituted is going to shift. You feel currently that you are local, in part constituted through the signal footprint that you happen to receive. And as that signal footprint mutates and shifts and shrinks and so forth, then suddenly your concept of the local is getting redefined on the fly, you know, possibly overnight, when you are no longer in the same relationship to this local community that you once thought you were. So with that in mind, I am having to strategically define a local as being the village, you know, something that I can do with 48 students at most, in a couple of weekends, because classes start in late January, and then, you know, we want to get this done. So I'll have the support of the city for, you know, the lists of households and that sort of thing. I'll divide them up into team captains and things like that. But strategically, I'm going to have to cut off, and this is where I'm going with this, I'm going to have to cut off the city of Newark, Ohio, which is right next door. It's 5 miles down the road, with substantially different socioeconomic demographics. And this is troubling, because the people, as we've pointed out, the people who most are at risk of not getting this information are not the people in Granville, Ohio, they're the people in Newark, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And yet, I can't cover 50,000 people, I can't, you know, I can't take on that task, I really can't. So that notion of a strategic local that excludes people who are served by the exact same cable carrier on the exact same system, you know, our systems are integrated, is a sort of policy decision that I'm making. To get back to this kind of concern about, like, how we make policy at this kind mm-hmm. of local level, is I'm making policy in a way that defines a local that excludes them. So, you know, the actual logistics of it, I don't think will be terribly difficult, but I do hope to problematize exactly how we're defining local community, how the socioeconomic status of Granville is actually making this project some. We have a lot of elderly, I guess that's a good thing.
I kind of wanted to follow up on this, because it seems like the sense that I'm getting from this whole thing, everything I've been hearing about, is it's been, educating the public has been spearheaded by the FCC, and not, there doesn't seem to be much local stuff going on, not that I've heard about or been talked about, with the exception for you here. Mm-hmm. Am I mistaken in that? Or?
I think you are.
Yeah, I think you are too.
I don't know what your station is doing, but I do know that our local PBS affiliate in Columbus, WOSU, has been encouraging people who know that they don't need the coupons to order the coupons anyway from the NTIA and then send them into WOSU, and then WOSU is taking them and redistributing them to those who don't know that they need the coupons.
Right.
So that's one aspect.
We haven't done that, but that's one that some people have used. I think that actually there's been a substantial amount of particularly sort of an increasing amount of communication coming out of the broadcasters about this effort. FCC is requiring, there's very specific FCC requirements for what you have to air, how much you have to air. We have to report quarterly to the FCC what we air, submit the report. There's a lot of pressure to make sure the report gets submitted and all of that. That said, there's also other initiatives, you know, here locally, for example, there have been utility bill stuffers, there's been cable company stuffers, we participated with the gas company on stuffers, there's seminars. We haven't done, you know, a multi-station local test here yet. That's something I think that we'll do yet. I do think that despite the fact that it's a massive public education effort that has to be underway, I think that part of the problem occurred because the emphasis on launching this effort occurred so early that the urgency was not there in from a time dimension. I mean, the notion that you were starting a public education effort about a February 17th, 09 turnoff before February 08 was crazy, because people were going to become massively confused about, you know, is it 08, is it 09, how does it work? And so I think that there's an element here, again, of not having well thought out strategically how that effort would be rolled out. And so a lot of us are really now just beginning to focus on it more aggressively as we begin to reach 5 months, 6 months out from the turnoff, and it'll increase substantially more over the next several months.
I'm also interested in the, again, the sort of the nature and scope of those public education efforts, mm-hmm. right? I mean, what would your students do if they knock on a door and someone says, why is this happening? I mean, are you educating them as to why this conversion is happening? And I can't help but think of, you know, other switches to digital technologies from analog technologies, and in particular looking at, you know, optical media, and one can only imagine if the FCC or if government had mandated that everyone switch from VHS to DVD. I mean, that seems ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, how would they have done that? But you have this consortia of companies who come together to standardize the technology, who do all this product testing, who make sure that when DVDs come out in the marketplace, that they function, number one, as they're designed to function. And when you have a completely different model for a conversion of this sort, when you have government essentially mandating that, okay, we're going cold turkey, we're working with manufacturers, but there isn't a kind of a collusive atmosphere of participation between these companies, these consumer electronics manufacturers, to develop the technology according to the market demands or their perceptions of the future of the technology or whatever, and it becomes a voluntary effort, but one that is standardized and one that is developed to the extent that the technology works. So when we get to the point where, you know, where we're introducing a technology as a mandate and there is a diffusion curve, what that diffusion curve, I'm assuming, will be different than a standard bell curve, because it's a mandated thing. Beyond that, you know, the whole notion of public education when it comes to these kind of mandated conversions is really interesting to me. Like, how do we educate the public, not just as to what's going to happen, you need to buy this box, here's how you set it up, here's how it's going to function, but why are they doing this? Why are they mandating this? Why do we have to know this? I mean, and to me, that gets at the heart of, number one of educating, you know, the public as to, you know, the activities of the FCC relative to industry, and, you know, their clear motivations to auction off, you know, but broadcast.
But you raise a really difficult issue from a practicality standpoint, because while this is a good opportunity to try to educate the public about the broader policy context, at the same time, the more complex your message,
right.
the yeah. less quickly it's absorbed.
Right.
And you know, if anybody else in here is a parent, you know that the just do it because I said so doesn't really work very well. And I don't know how well it'll work in this mode, but you go out and somebody says, well, gosh, why are we doing this? You know, is the answer, I don't really understand it. Just do it. If you want TV, put it in the stinking box. You know, I know that you miss an opportunity when you do that, but at the same time, you know, the more complex you make it, the tougher it may be to affect.
Especially given the political economic assumptions that go into, for instance, the converter boxes. One thing that bothers me is that the converter boxes that were mandated by the FCC as sort of the base minimum, this is what the converter boxes have to be able to do, do not include analog pass-throughs. Mm-hmm. That means that you can't receive analog signals, run them through the digital or through the box and pass exactly. them through to your analog television. At the same time, as you kind of suggested, there are a lot of stations that are not going to be making this digital transition. In February of 2009, mostly low-powered television stations, which includes a lot of religious broadcasters, mm-hmm. which includes a lot of the most local yeah. of local stations.
Some 3,600 nationwide,
absolutely. Yeah, yeah. A bunch of them. And by failing to mandate a converter box that can actually do this, the FCC in a lot of ways betrays what its political economic mm-hmm. program is in a way that even those who would rather see them as screw ups than evil. Yeah. maybe that's an either or fallacy, but nonetheless, I think it's highly problematic for the stated aims of localism, diversity,
I think that's a really important point. I mean, the other issue apart from the policy context is technically this is actually more complicated than the public education efforts want to say. I mean, right. the nuances in the boxes, I mentioned the fact that the boxes perform differently. Mm-hmm. Then you've got analog pass-through issues. Then right. you've got the antenna issues.
Yep.
Suddenly this, just go buy the box, get the coupon, buy the box, stick it on, you'll yep. be fine.
Yeah.
In the case. Yep. And, that does concern me, and it concerns me not only because some people may not get TV or may not get good TV, it concerns me because as a broadcaster, particularly as a public broadcaster who has a perception, an image in the community of having this responsibility, we're going to get flooded by calls of people saying,
right.
I can't get this, come help me. And there are PBS stations in other parts, we're not, but in other parts of the nation, that are actually mobilizing engineering staffs to go out to viewer homes and help them hook up their boxes. We don't have the resources to do that.
There's a website, teletruth.org, that actually enacted some kind of like converter box test in New Jersey and discovered that even converter boxes are fraught with problems, and a lot of them just failed when they did a digital shutoff. And then, yeah, right, it was like, wow, we agree on something, alert the media.
I'm actually just curious about whether or not this is going to meet with resistance, in the sense that there is, at least among a certain percentage of the American population, a resistance to government action, to government intervention, intrusion, etc. Whether or not, like you're talking about sending engineers into homes to help with the conversion, and are people going to be willing to install these analog boxes? Are they going to be happy at that? And what's the blowback about that?
We haven't seen. I'd be interested to see what you guys hear. We haven't seen so far any strong opposition to this, but it wouldn't surprise me if you ran into that, particularly on the last to adopt population.
Yeah.
But secondly, after the boxes are in, when people start to realize some of the functionality that's enabled in the boxes, that's a whole other issue. It's not just, you're no longer just dealing with a Nielsen diary. I mean, you've got companies like Rentrak and others out there that have been taking information off of chips embedded in set-top boxes for years and provided them to studios in order to make sure royalties get paid, that now can monitor your viewing behavior on second-by-second basis and know differences in the TV in your kids' room versus the TV in your living room. And, it becomes the Randall's frequent shopper card kind of data phenomenon where the sort of things that one knows about you become substantial. As a broadcaster, that makes me excited because maybe I'll be able to break outside of the Nielsen monopoly. But, as a viewer, it can worry a little bit.
Well, and I'm also thinking about these, the twin discourses, not just of surveillance, but of censorship. You know, and would this be perceived as something that not only allows the big government to track you, but also to keep you from getting the religious broadcasts, the hyper-local stuff, the stuff that you want, because it's anti-establishment or it's what the government doesn't want you to know. And that's part of what I'm kind of curious about.
TBN has got to be on top of this. In other words, the big religious broadcasters were on this 10 years ago, probably. It's this very, very small local stuff. It's probably more public access religious programming than the majority of stuff, which is very top down. But as I said, TBN, huge, huge global networks.
But I can see this thing feeding into, an almost... I mean, conspiracy theories
malicious.
You might see malicious spring up about this sort of thing.
This is definitely antichrist kind of worthy.
Sure.
At the same time that TBN probably figured this out long before anyone at ABC did.
Yeah.
Because they've always been at the forefront of new technologies. Even
just
if you can go by evil.
Just beware if they assign you a number. That's when they come out from behind. That's when you're dead.
But I think that Mitchell's point is that there is going to be this reservoir, and this feeds into it, there is going to be this reservoir of citizen anger, and then the question then becomes, I mean, your policy proposals that you go through there, I can't help but thinking that ship has sailed. And yet, is there some way in which this anger can be mobilized, and if so, how do we go about capitalizing on that at this late
date? What I'm thinking might be the way to approach that would be, and this might be a matter where you could get the ball rolling with maybe a few conference calls, where you actually contact representatives of organizations, of groups that are going to be disaffected, so like the AARP, the NAACP, the Association Regarding Assistive Technologies, groups like in Chicago, coalitions with regards to public housing. These groups that basically represent these, perhaps at local scales, perhaps at national scales. I mean, in Chicago alone, we're talking, by my estimate, 630,000 people who stand to be affected. Well, you have advocacy groups on behalf of those. Get them in to, say, look, this is going to happen. There could be a window of opportunity for this where this could be a big deal and will be on people's radars. So be ready to push this when that opportunity comes. And that's, I think, how, if there's going to be any way to do that within this window that we could have for who knows how long, that might be the best way to give this a try, at least. I mean, if other people have other ideas, I'm all ears.
I've been actually wondering kind of the same thing. And a lot of you guys,
go ahead.
A lot of you mentioned that this might be an opportunity to have the public have a say or get involved in things. And I'm seeing with the KXAN, there's nothing, and I don't know if maybe you've seen more than me, but there's not even anything in the newspaper. People, and as maybe just where I live, but I can't even get a broadcasting on the funny ears for NBC. So I'm online, but not everybody is. So I don't know, maybe if there's somebody there to mobilize people and funnel that somehow, it might work, but I just don't know if people are just gonna kind of say, well, that's what I'm being given,
I think it's fascinating, and that's such a fascinating example because you think that would be something that would cause people to go up in arms, because it's kind of a little microcosm of what could happen on February 17th if the worst, case scenarios get resolved. But Time Warner's response was fascinating to it. You don't have to have KXAN. Go to NBC.com and watch your content. Now, not everybody can do that. I know, and I fully understand that.
Nobody's even saying you can go watch it with an antenna, though, which I think is...
That's right, but it was the fact that there was this NBC.com option that gave Time Warner the option to kind of throw that up as being...
And they had video instructions on their web that they were broadcasting on that channel.
Fascinating.
Yeah.